imagine that you actually, you're going for cardiothoracic surgery or neurosurgery, and you learn that your physician, that she spent the last 20 years reading about neurosurgery, but she's never done a single operation before. That's not comforting. You want someone who says, no, I've done about 3,000 of these operations in the last year alone. What happens when things go sideways? That's where the experience comes in. How do we remediate these issues when they arise? And so our current educational model is not tied to solving these practical problems. Two most important things I think that human beings need to learn how to do, which we don't learn in any school, which is one, conflict resolution, and two is financial management. Our schools don't do that. And those are fundamental things.
That's Sheldon Gilbert, entrepreneur and founder of Kura Labs, a cloud infrastructure computing training and job placement nonprofit academy for underserved communities. You're listening to Dear Human Resources, and I'm your host, Marilyn Germain. On the show today, we're going to discuss how alternative education paths will empower marginalized communities. Good to have you on the show, Sheldon.
Thanks so much, Marie, for having me.
So let's imagine graduating from journalism school without even opening a Word document, or earning an MBA without even touching a spreadsheet. And yet, every year, universities across the country mint computer science graduates who have never used GitHub, for example. The traditional college education model, which is somewhat ill-prepared to provide the functional training for employment in the digital economy, offers limited variable career pathways, especially for our underserved communities. In an effort to stem the tide, if you will, of the emerging workforce crisis, where nearly one in three Americans have limited to no digital skills, more individuals are utilizing alternative educational and training models, such as vocational academies and hands-on boot camps, to gain relevant industry experience as more valuable pathways for long-term careers. So Sheldon, since you focus mainly on underserved communities, can you tell our listeners how you define the term?
You hear these terms, underserved, you also hear under-resourced, and as the name suggests, these are communities that largely have limited resources, and these are typically due to long-standing structural impediments. This is largely considered around sort of socioeconomic lines, areas that oftentimes where there's, you know, limited educational resources, health resources, banking resources, a lot of communities with low average household incomes. And so, as we all know, the typical refrain that oftentimes where one's, you know, zip code typically ends up determining the trajectory of their lives has become far too common and sadly the case.
So you say that it's very challenging for marginalized communities to find employment in the tech sector. Why do you think that's the case?
There are a couple of things that are important to understand, which is that I think writ large, there is a very fundamental disconnect between academia and the employment sector, particularly around technology companies. Listen, it doesn't matter if you've gone to a fancy school like I did. I went to Yale, or you graduate from Stanford or Caltech or Carnegie Mellon or MIT with a CS degree or PhD. What I think many would agree is that largely a lot of your education there is largely theoretically based, and you know, you're dealing with, you know, a lot of abstract notions, and which is vastly different from what is really required in the private sector, where you're required to actually build industrial grade enterprise level software applications that actually have to scale based on real world commercial conditions. And so if you're looking at a lot of these premier institutions where we see there's still a fundamental disconnect, imagine what it's like to actually never have access to some of those premier universities where the vast majority of Americans are. And so the opportunities for them to actually enter the tech economy, the innovation economy, is that much more limited. The other thing I would say is that I sort of say this is a little akin to sort of inside baseball. It's not unlike working at some of the premier firms in Wall Street, where, you know, to get a job at Goldman or Morgan Stanley is largely a function of what college you went to, if you were on the right crew team or lacrosse team, or if you were belong to the right fraternity at some of these prestigious universities. It becomes sort of the self-selecting network of who you know as well as who you went to school with. And that is also tends to be the case, particularly in some of the major employers in the tech sector, whether it's, you know, the Metas and the Apples of the world. It's typically who you knew and who you went to school with. And you're working with a lot of really important new technologies. And that typically is no one is availed to those opportunities, whether they're for internships, who are not within those circles.
Now, from a more practical standpoint, how does your company help underserved communities land tech jobs specifically?
I would take a step back, and the first thing I would say is that is understanding the landscape in technology in particular, and the technology could be in a very simplified way, could be seen as basically two major strands. There's an area of software development, or writing actually software code and so forth, and building applications. And then there's another layer, Marie, which is really around the sort of the hardware and infrastructure side. And I would actually argue that for a long time, that in many ways, the sort of how you program in Java and so forth and writing software applications has been largely a white collar. This is sort of my own sort of own classification. No one else is saying this, but I'm saying largely white collar. Numbers, which school do you go to, and could you actually think and write code and so forth to a large degree? Although that's receiving a great deal of pressure, because now a lot of companies could now outsource and go to Kiev at one point, or go to Hyderabad and whatever, and actually hire engineers at a fraction of the price here in the United States. And that's become fairly commonplace in terms of software development. No one really talks about their hardware side. When you actually write the code, what machines are that application really going to run on? Enter the world here of cloud computing, where they've seen this massive shift towards on-demand or elastic computing, which requires a completely different skill set. And there's been this long-standing workforce imbalance, at least in the last 10 years, with the rise of cloud computing. There are very few cloud engineers, DevOps engineers, SysOps engineers, and data ops engineers and data engineers in general. And so there's been this massive workforce imbalance, there's far more demand than the supply of these engineers. So we began first by examining where there's this acute asymmetry between supply and demand in the marketplace. And it turns out that cloud infrastructure in particular, there's a great need since everyone's migrating to the cloud. And so you saw there's really no canonical curriculum that's ever been established. There's really no pipeline for training. So I saw this really as an opportunity. And the second thing I'd say to itself is I think of that layer of affectionately as digital plumbing. It sort of lends itself in many ways to sort of a vocational-like consideration, where you've got these very discrete sets of things that you're doing when you're networking computers, connecting them, and so forth, and having various applications that run on them. And so given that sort of vocational consideration, in many ways in that world, it doesn't matter what school you've gone to, if you've gone to school at all. If you've been tinkering around with a server since you're 17 years old in your parents' basement, guess what? You actually have legitimacy. There's a lot more street cred as a result of actually the experience of doing that. So that was a very important consideration for us. It's really focused on what you can do, less so about what school you've gone to. Have you actually brought up systems before? Have you actually wired RES systems before? Have you actually leveraged Terraform and actually scaling and deploying infrastructure? How do you use Kubernetes to for your entire cluster? Those are the things that really matter the most. And these are burning points for a lot of organizations. So we understand what that pain point. And the question is, okay, so how do you actually identify people? How do you actually train people for this? We were able to do so by virtue of really focusing on what I called people who are systems thinkers, right? The analogy I always like to share, which happens to be true, is like, look, chances are if you've actually been working at a restaurant since you're, I don't know, 19, 20 years old and putting yourself through college, and you've been managing the inventory management system, the cash register, the billing systems, the staff management systems, you don't realize it yet, but that restaurant's really set up like a microservices architecture. You've got these different hubs of functionality. I don't know, the hostess, he or she, they're effectively a load balancer that's managing incoming traffic, and you're also an API across those different systems. And the kitchen is effectively the database. You actually have orders going in there. That's a streaming order queue that could be akin to Kafka. And the point here is there are all these mental models and rubric and terminology that you may not be aware of, but you actually understand cross-system dependency. You understand how things are being processed. You've been doing it for a long time successfully, but you don't know what those systems are. And so if you've been able to manage that job, operate that system, understand dependency, manage work with clients, understand things, we can train you in these other digital systems. It's worked out. So what we say is, look, there's certain things that we can train. We can train unyielding curiosity, high work ethic, and resourcefulness. That we can train. We can identify for that. We can try and identify those attributes, but we can't teach that. What we can teach is we can teach you Python, Jenkins, Kubernetes, and Docker. That we can teach you, right? So given that, we were able to basically develop this entire curriculum. It's fully online, fully remote. Classes are 6 to 9, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, all day Saturdays. And the focus has always been on understanding the fundamental problems that companies are trying to solve and learning which particular technologies are used to actually solve those issues for them. And so we begin at a very fundamental level. First, understanding operating systems at their core, learning about the Linux operating system. I don't want to bore you with all the details. I'm happy to kind of walk you through our curriculum, but beginning first with, you know, scripting and learning Bash and then learning Python for automations and then building out networks and VPCs, learning about EC2s and learning how to manage virtual machines as well as containerizing your applications for minimizing configuration drift to databases and APIs. By the end of the program, I tell people all the time, there are two questions that are perhaps the most important questions for getting any job. I don't care what job it is. Well, you want to basically are working as a nurse, or you want to work as a pilot, or you want to work as a software engineer. The questions typically center on these two things, which is that, well, Marie, that's great. Could you tell us what Excel is? Most people could actually answer that question. Could you tell us what Docker is? Most people could actually answer that question. You do a little bit of research on YouTube, you could figure out that answer. The second question is the most important question. This is actually where the music stops, which is that, Marie, could you actually tell us about 3 or 4 cash flow models or balance sheet models that you've actually done using Excel over the last 2 or 3 years? Mm. Or could you tell us about the systems that they've actually built using Docker, using Terraform? The vast majority of people cannot answer that question. They don't have the functional experience to ever point to actually get the job, which causes that vicious cycle. Mm. And so our entire curriculum is centered around actual work that has actually been, that's required for these jobs. So the way that we train people is that by the time you actually go for your interviews, you could actually answer those questions with a great deal of confidence, because chances are you will have done a project and infrastructure using Docker at least 25 times that you could actually point to. So we basically take 2 or 3 years worth of work and we collapse that. We condense that basically into about 6 months. So it's deeply functional work, which tends to really work out well by the time our students go for the interviews, and they do that quite well, and they actually work at these jobs and they have a higher retention rate as well as a high promotional rate, as a matter of fact. And these are all Fortune 500 companies. You're talking about the NASDAQs, Morgan Stanley's, Bloomberg's, JP Morgan Chase, S&P Global, DraftKings of the world. We've actually had about an 85 to about 90% placement rate with people who actually had no technical background. Within 6 months, this starting salaries tend to be anywhere between $100,000 and coming from households of $20,000 to $30,000. We've effectively moved them up 2 or 3 tax brackets within a short period of time.
So Sheldon, we talked earlier about alternative education paths, and we talked about people enrolling in vocational academies and hands-on boot camps to gain relevant industry experience, which you've just talked about. Do you think it's the future of training and perhaps even education? In many fields, including engineering, people must acquire some theoretical knowledge taught in universities, don't you think?
I don't want to discount the importance of a liberal arts education. I'm a beneficiary of that. In fact, my background is really in molecular genetics. That's why I studied undergrad. And some people oftentimes ask me, like, well, how'd you go from that to actually now, you know, programming and database engineering that you did earlier on and so forth? I said, well, to me, they're incredibly connected. I think of the genome as basically a massive self-regulating database. Forget AI. Look at the genome and how it actually orchestrates the turning on and turning off of particular genes selectively to actually have certain protein outcomes. But that's been my mental model, right, for thinking along those ways. In fact, object-oriented programming was actually invented by a molecular biologist. That's why we have terms like polymorphism and inheritance. So that's the point, is like this sort of cross-pollination of domains are incredibly important in terms of activating these interesting logical extensions of various ideas and concepts. I think that's where innovation typically comes. So I certainly celebrate that. The problem that I have, Marie, is that the cost of that degree has vastly outpaced the economic utility of that degree. And on top of that, when you have a lot of communities where the terms are, these are usury terms on terms of those interest rates. I mean, I hear people who actually graduate from certain schools and they're like $500,000 in debt. That's right. Compounding at 27%. That's insane. They'll never be able to pay that back. And so the job that they have to look forward to is probably driving Instacart. That makes no sense. It's untenable. It has to be completely recalibrated. So I think the market's actually forcing us to reevaluate the models where we're not necessarily impugning a liberal arts education. What we're centering is saying, what are the relevant jobs for the 21st century economy? Oh, and by the way, I think this actually underscores the need for more critical thinking, because yes, there are aspects in which AI, generative AI, will start to automate certain perfunctory tasks, which now increases the need for you to actually understand, okay, if I'm going to build this particular trading system, and instead of actually writing on my own some of the code for my API calls in Java or in Python, I could actually have GPT-4 or Llama spin that up for me. That's great. But why do I need this particular API? What data do I need to extract? And how will I actually manage a 30 millisecond latency pocket if I'm trading with people in Luxembourg? Like, you still have to sort of think about the business problem, and it's going to require, and those engineers, in fact, who actually tend to do very well in industry, I tell people all the time, understand the technology gets you in the door. Knowing how the technology is being applied to drive the business and solve the business problems will actually allow you to keep your job and to excel at your job as well. And so that's what we begin with, that. That's our North Star. What are the problems that are being solved in agriculture, climate change, genomics, electrical vehicle? What you choose your domain, they're discrete problems they're trying to solve applying technology. And so I think that one has to reevaluate that entire educational pipeline, because it does not exist. That tethers and couples tightly industry and works backward from industry to understand the problems that they're solving. I mean, imagine this, like, imagine that you're going for cardiothoracic surgery or neurosurgery, and you learn that your physician, that she spent the last 20 years reading about neurosurgery, but she's never done a single operation before. You got to be kidding me. That's not comforting. You want someone who says, no, I've done about 3,000 of these operations in the last year alone. You need a functional experience. And the idea is that what happens when things go sideways? That's where the experience comes in. How do we remediate these issues when they arise? And so our current educational model is not tied to solving these practical problems. And by the way, if I just go off on a tangent for a second, if you ask me the two most important things I think that human beings need to learn how to do, which we don't learn in any school, which is one, conflict resolution, and two is financial management. Our schools don't do that. And those are fundamental things.
There is some anxiety across U.S. companies to remain competitive in the 21st century economy. How does improving hiring and retention of engineering talent help to solve that anxiety?
I think the anxiety is entirely founded. I think that, look, if you're thinking just not in terms of our competitiveness in terms of industry, but just even in terms of from like a primal defense consideration in terms of cybersecurity, we see how vulnerable and most nation states are when they're not protecting their polling systems, their electrical grids, their utility systems. So the nuclear power plants, I mean, you know, that's a whole other podcast. We could talk about all the vulnerabilities that exist. And not to mention the two main innovative threads that are hanging here in the balance with regards to first generative AI and creating far more sophisticated levels of code very quickly, by the way, as well as quantum computing. Once that becomes a reality, nearly all of our cryptographically secured mechanisms of defense will have to be fully reconsidered, right? And so the United States, rightfully so, has to be concerned about, and not to mention a great deal of our engineering talent has been largely brought in from other countries, because for a long time in the 1970s, actually had particular sponsored programs out of India, out of Eastern Europe, bringing people here for PhDs and various programs here in the United States. And so given the current geopolitical environment, all that's being reconsidered. So it's incumbent upon the United States to start to invest in a lot of the sort of often overlooked deep reservoirs of talent in this country, right? The capacity is there. No one's actually made the investment, and we have to. We have no choice.
So I assume it's going to be very important for HR professionals to find engineering talent over the next 5 or even 10 years, right? Can you share any specifics about that?
I think that, and this is certainly not new, but one has to reconsider the filters and framework by which we try and assess talent potential. Looking for people who actually have 7 years of experience using Terraform. Terraform has barely been around for 7 years. There are these things that are just actually not well aligned with the reality on the ground. And so, or even the fact that they need to go to a certain university, a top 50 school, or they need to go to university at all. A lot of these things, a lot of the people who are the most skilled at these things have never gone to university. Some of them made the trade-off like, I can't afford university, but the way I'm going to be able to support myself is by basically building database systems for my local shops in my neighborhood here in Madison, Wisconsin. That's how I supported myself. And that person probably knows more than those people in the CS departments and most of the colleges where they could have attended. It's that deep functional experience. So it has to begin with, as we know, moving from a certificate-based economy to a skill set-based economy is trying to understand what experience do people actually have with these technologies. And even if they don't have the experience them directly, what are the sort of proximal experience that they actually have? So I see that your background is in accounting and finance. You built fairly elaborate dynamic cash flow models while you're an accountant at this particular company at H&R Block. And now you're learning Python. And clearly you understand about how to build fairly extensive algorithms and models in Excel. And I see how you're now trying to appropriate that and leverage that in Python, but you also understand that we are an accounting firm and we're building this particular software. I would argue that person deserves a second look, even though they didn't go to a college and they don't have a degree in computer science. They have a lot of functional experience that's there. So I think it's really centered around, you know, that functional experience that people have around certain technologies.
So you mentioned earlier that you place some of your students in very high in Fortune 500 companies. What are key tech roles and skills that companies, including Fortune 500 companies, are looking for in new hires so that their new employee hit the ground running once they enter the position? And what role, once again, do HR professionals play in helping to solve that challenge?
Well, I think there are a couple of things here that are incredibly important. The world has changed, as we all know, since COVID. And so the notion of what it means to hire someone in this new environment. I mean, there's some crazy things that were going on. I call it salary arbitraging or interview arbitraging. We saw certain things where literally, and I talked to a couple of companies that said, no, we saw this at least 30% of the time. I'm like, really? Marie, someone's interviewing you for the job. But meanwhile, you have an earpiece and you're talking to someone else who's giving you the answers while you're being interviewed. Marie, tell us about how you built something using Docker. And then there'd be a pause and someone else heard the question and they're feeding you the answers. You would actually get the job, but you're actually not doing the work, Marie. Someone else, let's say in Manila, is doing the work. So a lot of odd things were happening during as a result of remote work. It's not to say that remote work is a bad thing. We're just saying that now companies have to develop really sophisticated ways now of vetting talent and evaluating talent in this new environment. So not only looking for people who are doing remote-only work, but also what does it mean to onboard someone in this new environment where, whether it's hybrid, because you're losing that sort of natural water cooler moment where you're there, you're new, and you actually hear the VP of technology talking about a new system. And just through osmosis, you're learning about how to actually build a new fraud detection algorithm by virtue of talking to the person. That's how learning was done. So more specifically, tactically, as for HR, the things that I see that people always are indexing on are these fundamental things, which is because everyone has, particularly for technology jobs typically have either a three-step or a five-step interviewing process. One is the first the phone call. We want to make sure that, you know, what you say is on your resume is in fact the case. Then, so it's basically 30 minutes to a second call to see if you have legs and a heartbeat. Okay, done. Then we actually, then if we like you and you think that you're fairly competent, we'll invite you in for an interview. There's a technical interview. It's a 1 hour interview with a one team. Then there's another technical interview. Then they come back again to meet with other technology people. And by the fourth interview, so you're meeting with the business units and then they're considering you hiring the job. Now, so what is that all designed to do? Designed to do a couple of things. The first thing they want to understand is, do you understand the kinds of problems that we are solving? Did you take the time to understand that we're NASDAQ, or that we're DraftKings, or that we're Tesla, or that we're Nike, or that we're Goldman Sachs? Are you understanding the kinds of problems? You may not know all the technology, but if you've actually spent time to show us that you've read, you've watched all the most recent YouTube interviews of our VP of technology and her talk at Davos, that you understand exactly how we plan to use AWS and aspects of Llama and GPT-4 for our integration for particular endpoints, for processing, trades, because all that information is there. We're evaluating the extent to which you spend time trying to understand us and the problems that we're solving. I really want to underscore that, because everyone thinks that these technology jobs are like, well, you got the question wrong, so you're not going to... No, not the case. They understand that. They look at it and see, did you spend time to understand the types of problems that we are trying to solve as a business? That's number one. Number two, how do you go about solving problems? So they'll give you those classical sort of coding problems and logic problems to solve. You may not necessarily get it right, but what you want to see is, how do you approach solving that problem? Did you jump right away to solve the problem? Did you say, okay, let me make sure I understand all the parameters correctly? You want to understand, if we were to stand up a new system in Palau, that's about 17 time zones away, and there's a 30 millisecond latency pocket, and we could actually use serverless components, that we could do this, right? So did you demonstrate the inclination to stop taking all the parameters from all those different dimensions, make sure that you're going down the right path? Were you being thoughtful about that? As you were solving the problem, did you kind of walk us through your thinking? Are there times where you didn't know the answer that you told us, I'm not really sure about how this works? Because now they know that they could trust you, because in the end, this is a team sport, and they want to know, like, are you the kind of person that they could work with? Are you agreeable? Are you open to feedback? Are you honest? Because here's the reality. 3 o'clock in the morning, a server goes down for about 20 minutes and people lose $1 million. How did you handle that? Did you pretend as if it didn't go down under your watch? Or it went down, but you were able to spring into action, escalate that up the chain, communicate that to the team and said, listen, this thing went down. Here's what I think the problems are. Here's what I think the potential solutions are, and I'm on it. That's what matters. You know, that famous question during the presidential debate interviews, the 3 o'clock in the morning call. Infrastructure engineers get those 3 o'clock in the morning calls all the time. And they want to know, are you going to be out drinking with your buddies in the West Village when you're on call? Or are you there manning the systems? So the questions are really centered around, do you understand the nature of the problems? Can you solve these problems? Are you resourceful enough to figure the technology? Are you a quick learner? Are you adroit with these different things? Do you show the sort of the mental agility to learn Docker over the weekend if you need to? Do you know how to go and ask for help? Are you trustworthy and are you honest? Are you a team player? Those are the things that they really index on, right? Because I tell you what happens. Right now we're in an economy where, like, man, some people are getting laid off. And so you have people who may have 10 years of experience that they go for an interview, let's say, to a certain company, and they're resting in their laurels. Like, listen, I wrote the code for the system. They should be honored enough to even be interviewing me, is what some people got to have, that attitude. And there are those who are saying, look, I really want this job, and I've spent the last 3 nights really reading all the articles, reading everything that I could, all the open source repos, everything I could on this particular company. Guess who's more likely to get that job? The latter. Because they weren't resting on any laurels. They spend time. It's like dating. Did you spend time really listening and understanding that person? Right? Did you read their profile and understand they have 2 kids? Right? So those are the things that employers really pay attention to, because they believe that once you have potential, they could train you up. But are you the kind of person that they really want to work with, is the question.
So we talk a lot about obsolescence of some professions and the emergence of others. Can you share best practices for transitioning talent from more vocational roles, like being an electrician, to working in different areas of technology, such as artificial intelligence, since you mentioned AI earlier?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I think that there is this unfortunate association with vocational jobs as not being intellectually rigorous, which is cannot be farther from the fact. I mean, in many ways, there's this whole educational industrial complex in this country, which is basically trying to sort of get people to go to college and largely to sort of finance that and so forth. But the reality is that the things that is required of a plumber. I mean, the way that plumbers think, electricians think, these, you know, medical assistants have to think when they're assisting in the OR with the surgeons. They may not be certified to do the orthoscopic knee surgery, but they know how the systems work really well. And so there's a whole framework here for logical dependencies that someone looking at an electrical circuit really understands. It's all logical frameworks and scenario modeling. Okay, we want to build a townhouse that's going to be using solar power, and it has to store the system down in the basement, but it's a 40-foot drop to then wire this into this bedroom that does this. But the house is facing the south, is northern facing, so the amount of sun exposure, like thinking about all those dependencies, that's precisely what's required in a lot of these jobs. And so the idea here is that just basically reappropriating the models and saying, okay, the same way you're actually thinking about a physical house and there's a blueprint that you use, it's no different from when you're actually building an infrastructure, microservices infrastructure. We literally, the same as a blueprint for a house, there's also a blueprint for that infrastructure, system design, a logical design. Oh, and by the way, I'll raise you one and tell you that not only do they actually have these designs for these things, they're literally files, these configuration files. We could actually automate spinning up machines. And that's called programs like infrastructures code, like Ansible or Terraform or CloudFormation that spin up these. And so you're talking about people who naturally think about inputs and outputs and logical processing and dependencies and exogenous stimuli into a system and the outcomes that are needed. They're trained in those ways. They think in terms of logic circuits and logical frameworks, and it naturally lends itself.
Fascinating discussion. I just have one short question about Cura Labs. Cura, it's written K-U-R-A. Where does that come from?
So the term Cura, actually, I didn't come up with it. It was actually one of the members of our team many moons ago when we think about a new name. And it turns out that Cura, I always like to go through, I run my own algorithms for coming up with names. The names also have meaning and so forth. And so Cura actually means to grow in Swahili. And so one of the things that we teach all the time is that this lifelong learning, the ethos of lifelong learning and continuously growing. And so it really, we felt it was appropriate in that regard. Cura Labs in this continual growth mindset.
And one last question for you about gender. Yes. I assume the majority of your students are males.
It is, but thankfully in the last few years, it's been getting closer being half women. And that's a very important thing for us, by the way, to continue.
I assume so. And it's refreshing to hear. Thank you so much, Sheldon, for sharing some very interesting insights.
Now, thank you so much, Marie, for having me.
Support for this show comes from Western Carolina University, a campus of the University of North Carolina system, with the technical assistance of Kelly Minnis.